netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for taking the time to download our podcast this week. I'm John Montgomery. Our guest on this episode is Steve Roberts, the CEO of Ion Software, makers of Fusion. And Steve and the folks at Ion have been good friends of FX Guide over the years, so it's always great to catch up. In fact, we prefer to refer to Steve as Le Grand Fromage, which is, for those who don't speak French, the big cheese. That's always what his name tag says at the trade shows, but it's great to catch up with him. They've been doing some interesting stuff, especially, I think, dealing with their collaboration with Uncharted Territory on working on Roland Emmerich's Anonymous. They can see firsthand what works, what doesn't. They can develop new tools that are needed on the job. And I think it just simply makes better software in the long term. So I think that's really interesting, especially some of their deep compositing stuff, which not to be confused with the stuff that Weta is doing as part of OpenEXR 2.0, but that kind of stuff is also very interesting. Another interesting aspect of their conversation I just want to tease a bit is their discussion on scene-referred linear compositing. I think many of you are used to compositing with a gamma of 1.0 in the linear workspace, but what this does is actually work in a color-managed workflow, taking into account the color space of your original source material. And I think as we acquire all these various digital formats that are happening and being brought into the market, I think this type of workflow is increasingly important, especially with the stuff that hopefully the Academy is doing to help standardize that. So anyway, let's go ahead and join that conversation now. It's Mike Seymour speaking with Steve Roberts.
So look, we wanted to discuss a couple of things, basically catch up with what you've been doing with the software, but also to follow up on a couple of aspects of the latest release. But I guess a general question to start off with, how has it been going for you recently?
It's been going well. We've kind of changed a little in what we've been doing. We've been doing this for a very long period of time, probably the longest of anybody. And we've kind of looking at what we were doing in terms of productions. And as things kind of get a little more complex in production, we kind of had the opportunity of working on with the crew at Uncharted Territories to do Roland Emmerich's Anonymous film, and so being more directly involved in that whole pipeline was a great opportunity for us, and we could basically set up and do specific technology that benefits everybody, but really push a pipeline down our way of thinking to produce, great images, basically, and great results.
Let's discuss that if we can, because that's one of the things I really wanted to talk to you about. Because in the last release, I think that was 6.2, there was a line certainly in the press stuff that was sent out about having a new deep compositing tool set. Now, deep compositing, something's close to my heart. I'm just wanting to know, is that the same sort of deep compositing stuff that, for example, Weta was suggesting for OpenEXR 2 at FMX last month, or is this something different? And that is stuff that's come from your work with Anonymous, isn't it?
Correct, it is. Yeah, that's, I mean, this is, well, kind of stems back quite a way. A lot from our particle system where we're doing a lot of clouds and things like that, where you have lots of little image planes generated in a particle system, and you have lots of transparency in those things, so you could actually then create a nice cloud and something could actually move through that as a 3D object, and so as you kind of extend that even further, you kind of want to then be able to, rather than have hard image planes where an object will clip a plane as it moves through and kind of pop, you now want to kind of blend between them. So basically you end up extending that further where you can actually start to create a volume of layers, kind of a bit like an MRI scan of layers back, but as you move through that extra Z dimension, you can actually blend between the layer. So anything that moves through that volume will then merge correctly, you know. So if it's cutting through 25 layers, things right in the back will be much more, you know, much more blended back than things that are in the foreground.
Right. So if I had like if I had this cloud that you're talking about, let's say it's a big patch of smoke from a campfire, yep. and we've got a shot that's looking across a campground. Obviously, if I had a single plane of rendered smoke, it would literally exist at one place. Something could either be in front of the smoke or behind it. You could do maybe a 50% mix, but in no sense would it move from the front or the back of the smoke, because the smoke is just one rendered piece of video. Now, what deep compositing is doing and what you're doing is saying, oh, okay, but if I understood that the smoke existed, you know, a bit in front of the fire and a bit behind the fire, then as somebody literally jumped over the fire, they would sort of be all behind the smoke, in the smoke, and then in front of the smoke, and that would be actually require the software to not just have a single depth value for where the smoke was in the scene, like it's, you know, 8 meters back in the scene, but actually require it to know it starts 6 meters back and extends back to 9 meters. And of course that means for every pixel we've got more information. Now that's incredibly good at contributing to realism, especially with particle system stuff. And you guys have always been very focused on adopting these sort of early relighting technologies and stuff. And I think that's a thing that I certainly have known Fusion for. So when did this actually sort of, this was in the last few months that this has been implemented, or when did it actually sort of come into the software?
Well, we started on Anomnous about 2 years ago, because that film wrapped around September last year. Its release schedules are, you know, not coming out to September this year.
Right.
So unfortunately, we can't show a lot for that until that that release actually comes out.
But this is in the hand of users now, right? Because it's in the current release.
Correct, yeah. But if we go back even further, like I was saying, where its origins were was a lot in the when we're coming out with Fusion 5, and then you start using the particle system actually in the 3D space. There was you use the particle system to create hundreds of image planes that are all volumetric, basically, in the 3D space. And so that's kind of where it really was starting, where you could actually build up a cloud of layers. But now what we're doing is something that's more precise, where you are taking slices of image all the way through a volume. And then so it's basically a three-dimensional volume image, right? A bit like a voxel sort of thing, but it's more like ray casting sort of thing. Now it's all been basically put into the GPU. It's all done as an OpenCL supercomputing sort of model, and it's and so even at 2K res, you know, you're doing this completely interactively, final finished images. Very interactively, like it, you know, it's like 5 or 6 frames a second when you're doing this, so you can move things through the space and everything.
I mean, we shouldn't skip over that, because that's, as I say, it's an enormous plus that it's that fast, given what it's doing.
It lends itself to the GPU really well, because you've got so many cores on board that you can just utilize to do that same type of operation all the time. So you can just, you just exploit that, your $150 game card can do that just fine, right?
So is this the volume masking tool? Is this the same thing?
Yes, it's all been built into the volume masking tool. And then In that we use things like, because we're mixing things that are coming out of a 3D system, so you're using the world position point pass basically as a way of generating a certain amount of occlusion in that volume. So you could actually so it then knows, because you put the camera into the volume and the same camera that was in the 3D system, it and the world position pass, it knows how to generate basically an occlusion of what's foreground, what's background with each little object with inside that. But yes, it's a kind of a deceptively powerful little tool because it does a few other things where you can actually just, you can either mask out surfaces within 3D and then it doesn't matter where the camera moves, they're actually locked to the world position pass, or you can actually then describe a volume within that, which would then use a basically, you know, a real fog volume. And so if you wanted to do relighting, you know, in on a side of a building, for example, you can just, you know, you can just slice that, you know, with the world pass and fog it and do all the changes directly on the 3D model without having to sort of like, you know, you're not doing polygons on, you know, on a 2D image, you know, 2D polygons, you know, you're actually working with the real 3D image then.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a really phenomenally powerful tool for getting stuff right, as it were. And it's funny, isn't it? Because it sounds natural. It sounds like what it should be like in the first place, but of course it hasn't been up until now. Hey, so you've been so much on the cutting edge of this. I mean, in fact, leading the curve or ahead of the curve on this. Will your implementation dovetail neatly in with the kind of things that are now being suggested in the broader like open source community, like OpenEXR 2, or is it that you'll have to do another iteration to get in sync with that more open source thing?
We're certainly going to be following that and working out how that works with our thing. We kind of made it accessible. All our passes are already done in EXR, but they're just layered slices. They're, you know, they're adding different types of data things. So, yeah, you know, we'll certainly see how that's going to kind of mesh with what we're doing, you know, down the track. So I'm sure we'll follow that extremely closely and see how it all fit.
Well, now, well, I've got you. I wanted to jump sort of tracks, if I can, and discuss something completely different, which is your support in Fusion for Red, in particular for Epic R3D. Where are you guys at with that?
Well, we're all up to the latest 4.1 SDK, and so far we've seen some Epic stuff come through. It looks pretty good to me. It's certainly been used and is used right now on a feature. So it's all up to date, really. Yeah.
Because one of the things I wanted to discuss with you, because you've got such an OpenEXR sort of underlying base technology, is probably the best way to describe it. In other words, that you know, it's not a bend for you to deal with OpenEXRs. It's completely comes naturally for the software. Clearly, a way of dealing with the HDRX part of Epic's footage, which is the two frames that are done to produce the increased dynamic range, is to treat those two frames separately. The trouble is, of course, that won't take any advantage of any software such as the stuff that is coming from Red for temporally adjusting the second frame to match the first. And so as we move forward, this kind of seems to be that if you could take the, say, Epic footage and, for that matter, other cameras that are doing now increased bit-level stuff and convert them into OpenEXR, or at least some kind of floating point sort of format like that, but I think OpenEXR is the obvious answer, you could go for a scene linear workflow. And I'm just wondering how much Fusion's looked at a scene linear workflow. In other words, a workflow where we're linear, no gamma, but a scene linear back to the original source, not obviously related to any kind of targeting. Is that something that you support in terms of color management workflow?
Oh, sure. I mean, yeah, again, just to kind of go back in history, I mean, we've pretty much been very flexible in adopting lots of different color methodologies throughout the history of the product. So we've been floating point for a decade now, and of course that's all HDRI. Our whole 3D system renders out HDRI, even out of the GPU. In going in this, we're gonna, you know, this becomes a which HDRX becomes a, how do you do tone mapping? Is the methodologies of the tone mapping in our thing going to be the same as other people? And I'll give you the example of that is debayering. if you debayer somebody's somebody's image, is that going to be the same from system to system? It is something that's going to have to be locked down into a standard in a way. You know, you don't want something tone mapped one way and then it's tone mapped differently by us, and then you end up the images don't cut together because they've come from two different shops, you know, and everything. So that is something that's going to have to be made common, you know, so in the whole process.
So let's discuss sort of color management, because I think this is what sort of it basically comes down to. The idea of working linear has been around now for a while, because obviously we don't want to be doing the maths of compositing, for example, using gamma curved affected imagery, because you know, we have to deal with the linearity of the maths, and so that linear workflow has been pretty good. And so the idea of taking imagery, and especially from a film world, without some kind of gamma on it is pretty well, I think, accepted as standard practice. But there still is the issue of what color space you're operating in. Now, you mentioned the debayering there. Let's take a Sony camera, because it's not just a red problem, or any, you know, professional camera that's shooting with a CMOS chip. It's going to have to debayer. And obviously, when it debayers from what is effectively a black and white bayer pattern to the color RGB, it has to pick a color space. Now, if it doesn't pick anything, it's going to go into the camera color space. But even if it picks nothing, the camera color space is a color space. And so then, of course, we normally matrix that to a color space. And so a good example of that would be a color space would be Rec 709. But if we're going to go linear, let's assume that we go to some other color space. And a prime contender for that is the new suggested color space from the Academy. And so there's been a move to looking at going to that color space, which is meant to be basically a sort of a stock neutral color space. But if I go to that color space, if I'm in a red, I might go to a red color space. How do I manage that color space side of the scene linear workflow inside Fusion and Ion software?
Yeah, good question. This is happening right now on a film we're helping with, where they've got lots of different digital cameras shooting things and they all have to match each other.
Because it's really hard stuff. I mean, this is, I'm not picking on you, but I mean, this is really the...
I know exactly, yeah. yeah, it's at one stage back in the 90s, it was, Cineon was a dominant force.
Yeah.
And they really got their color science down really, really well. And once everything was in Cineon and everybody made everything work to Cineon, the whole color pipeline worked very well.
Yeah, we had a really good target, didn't we, to hit. We knew that
exactly.
It was the color space of Cineon. We also knew it was a log file. And we also knew that the log file didn't have a gamma in it. So we were all pretty happy. But, of course, it was a 10-bit log file. And we're not going to be 10 bits in an OpenEXR environment. We're going to be half 16-bit float. And so all bets are off, because you're not going to use that color space necessarily as your OpenEXR color space.
Correct. And then you get into the whole thing of gamut. How broad is the color gamut going to be? Like, and again, in Fusion, there's a whole gamut conversion thing. And if you have a look at the whole curves or the triangles that it creates, you can actually see the difference between Rec 709 and sRGB are kind of close, a little different. But, you know, then you go to something that's broader and you can see how much more gamut that you've got.
Let me set it up for somebody that's listening, just to make sure everyone's clear that's listening, because I know you know this. But, like, obviously, if I wanted to had a project, I'm already in Fusion, I'm happy, and I want to target what that's going to look like when it's on a particular projected film stock. I might apply a 3D LUT, and that 3D LUT is not going to be baking in this. It's just going to show me that picture through the glasses, if you like, of to use that metaphor, of a 3D LUT that will simulate what that would look like as a projected color space in an environment, which makes total sense. And, of course, inside Fusion, it manages color well. The problem, though, is that if one of the images that is in the scene came from an ARRI and another one came from a red, and they both started at different color spaces, then both of their idea of what red is fundamentally slightly different at the point that I'm starting to apply this 3D LUT. So even though the 3D LUT is doing a great job in simulating that end deliverable experience of projected film, of course, you've got two different, slightly different reds feeding in. So there would be two slightly different results shown up on the screen. And so the challenge, I guess, to companies like Ion is as that target has moved off a well-understood target of Cineon to this, to a Cinelinear workflow, and also to the idea of the new IIF Academy stuff, is to, you know, because it's not really under your control, is it? I mean, you can't fully control the color spaces that people are generating in.
No, exactly right. Well, some companies have done well on the camera side, and talking about camera manufacturers, for example, Arri's done a really good job because of their film background to actually match film. And so if you wanted something that you knew was rock solid out of an Alexa, you choose their Cineon mode out of that, and you would get an output. And they even do crosstalk between the channels up in the extended range and things like that. So it emulates what film did very well. Red don't do really any white papers on what their cameras do. And when they've gone along, they kind of go, oh, here's Red Science too, and things like that. But, you know, it's like, okay, now look between the modelable conversion things that come out of that, and you go, okay, what is it supposed to be, and things like that. And they're not the only ones that do that either. I mean, the SI2K has different outputs. You know, it's like I've got this decode curve, and I've got this other decode curve, and they of the data, and it's like, and you look at the values of that and going, okay, it's not anything like a Cineon, even though you call it Cineon. Yes, what are the colours going to be?
But look, in your position as a bit of an industry leader, because obviously you've been around for a while, I mean, is it even a valid thing to say, like, I understand what you're saying with Arri and that targeting the film thing, but I could be, if I could be somewhat argumentative just for the purposes of this podcast, why even bother going to targeting film? I mean, if we've got this digital acquisition from my Alexa or my Red or my SI2K, why should I be worrying about profiling film? Because that's just, you know, a different, in some would I even argue, previous technology. So, and
true, and in a way, now with so much digital production, you know, projectors everywhere, and that's pretty much what you know, with the silver screens and the you know, the Christies and things like that. That space for DCP output is Rec 709 with a 2.2 gamma, and that's probably going to become the main mastering color space, I think, you know, in the end, because that's what DI works with, right?
But you're not going to do any of your maths inside your software with that gamma, surely? You would be doing that just as an end process.
Correct, yeah. Yes. Yeah, except for some of the commercial guys.
Yeah, sure.
But see, that's the flexibility. The commercial guys...
The poor buggers are still dealing with the NTSC.
Yeah, they still, you know, they still work directly in that format, right? I know down the track when I'm allowed to talk about this, but yeah, we're doing something directly on another film right now that is all around about getting the camera profiles and color profiles consistent between all these different cameras. And it's an interesting project to sit there and actually analyze all these different outputs and everything, and what are the specs supposed to be for all these things?
I mean, as I said earlier, I'm absolutely in no means suggesting that Ion isn't taking a terrific position on this. It's just, and so my questions aren't so much to draw attention to anything that I think should or shouldn't be done at Ion, but rather just, Steve, your position as an industry kind of, you know, sort of senior godfather figure that's been around for a while, because it is a challenge facing us in every part of the thing. And I guess this reflects a broader discussion, which is that I'd like to get your opinion also, which is that this idea of post, you know, a while ago we started talking about, you know, it isn't really post because it happens earlier upstream. But now increasingly, a lot of these issues are almost pre-production issues in the sense that you need to map this out. I mean, the workflow really shouldn't be a matter of somebody shooting something in isolation and handing it over a nominal wall to the guy in post, in inverted commas, because managing all this stuff through, and you must be seeing Fusion software used on set and stuff as well for, you know, previous test comps and all that kind of stuff, much more actively.
Correct. Yep. Yes, quite a bit. Yeah. There's the power of the laptop for you. You know, it's always there, having to be used on set, you know, testing things all the time. Yeah, the new digital world for cameras is now quite a you know, throws so much of the, you know, questions back open again about what is everything supposed to be, you know, what are our actual references, you know, and everything. So
and I think, yeah, also so in the case of Fusion, you've got such strong 3D tools that we're also, if we're merging the line between post and production, you've also pretty much, you know, slammed the line of difference between 2D and 3D.
Yes, yeah, we got a great note from somebody a little while ago that said, I didn't understand why you would go down so heavily down this path of 3D, but I now understand that the only way I could implement what I needed to implement was in this, and I couldn't do it in any other program. You know, it's a great comment, you know, when it came as thanks. And so, yes, the whole thing for us is the 3D system and pushing heavily with the GPU, because it you have to solve so much in, you know, very, very quickly. And the faster you can do that, you know, the more interactive you are, the better things are solved. And just to quickly go back to Anonymous, I mean, it wasn't just the volume stuff in this, but it's the whole water simulations and all the 3D environments. So much of those 3D environments are actually done inside Fusion.
Well, even a matte painting, you know, in the old days, a matte painting was a 2D thing. Matte paintings now really are digital environments. And so the concept of just, you know, pulling off a set extension, it's not enough to just, you know, comp up with a still generated in Photoshop comped in Fusion. You now have to, you know, produce an incredibly detailed and in some cases stereoscopic real dimensionalized world.
Yes, yeah, that's true. And there's moving objects, you know, so it can't be you know, it's not locked off camera and just something fixed, you know, the you know, details need to be in the foreground, background. Things are moving, people are moving in front of things, scene replication, you know, crowd replication and everything, you know, the believability of a scene, you know, as you put so much detail in there to give it scale and everything is very important.
So, look, if somebody wants to hook up with you and follow up with a more kind of detailed run-through and stuff, I guess, will you be at SIDGRAPH in Canada this year?
Yes. Yeah, we'll be out there doing our bit as always at SIDGRAPH. So
and looking further down the calendar, do you also support SIDGRAPH Asia? I mean, where are the best places for people to in the calendar year, depending where they are? Because obviously, people listening to this podcast are all over the world. Where is it, are you going to be at any other shows, major places that people can touch base?
IBC is our next one after that in Amsterdam. Great. Basically. Yeah.
Well, look, I can't thank you enough for taking time to talk to us and getting your thoughts on some of these really pressing issues. And, of course, there's a bunch of really good stuff available in sort of more depth and stuff over at the ION website, isn't there?
Correct, yes. Yeah, there's product pages, and there's also our YouTube channel that shows a fair bit of this stuff. And then also offline out of this, we can show you, get images from Anonymous. We had approval on about 6 or 7 images to show out of this.
Terrific. Well, we're going to be following up with Anonymous as a separate story as well, which is great, and just covering that film in depth. But I did want to get to you on some of these technical issues because, as I think I said in one of the Fusion forums recently, I first saw your software back in Crow's Nest at... you know, many years ago, far more years than I would actually want to actually publicly state right now. So you really have been addressing and helping the market for a very long time. So we do appreciate it.
Yes, Genghis Khan was the Mongolian restaurant there.
I remember it well. Well, thanks so much. Yeah. We do appreciate it, Steve. Thank you.
Well, good to catch up with Steve, and I appreciated the discussion on this idea of scene-referred profiles and working in linear workspace. You have actually been able to do that in applications at this point. After Effects is a good example, where for recent releases, you've been able to have a color-managed linear light working space with scene-referred profiles when you're bringing footage into it, and then well as apply a profile on output. But the workflow, honestly, is still new, I think, far from perfect, but it's really nice to see them taking a stab at it. In fact, their DNG, digital camera negative format, also embraces the idea of having scene-referred profiles as part of the spec kind of built in. So I think that's interesting as well. Well, that's it for this week. From my fellow FX Guide co-founders, Jeff Huser and Mike Seymour, we really appreciate the support of all of you taking the time to listen as well as provide feedback. It really means a lot to us to hear from you, so thanks for that. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.